Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We have two speakers talking about facing the dragon, meeting life's challenges head on. Elizabeth Lancaster and Joanne W. Jones. I'll introduce them both briefly. They're here on the occasion of the publication of their respective books. Elizabeth Lancaster is an occupational therapist by training, and she won the Finch Memoir Prize for the book Marzipan and Magnolias, which has recently been released. And Joanne W. Jones is a counsellor and a long-time writer, and she's here on the occasion of the release of her book When the Brow Breaks, which was a finalist in the Finch Memoir Prize. And despite the fact that the two authors competed and only won, they're both here today, and not only do they share writing in common, but they are members of the same yoga club. Which is the first for the Sydney Institute that we've had members of the same yoga club here on the same night. So off we go. Now I just worked it out, I forget who's first, but it's either Elizabeth or Joanne. Okay. So it's Joanne.
Yes.
Leading off, and then Elizabeth, and I'll put the books back and welcome.
Thank you. After that wonderful introduction, I don't think I need to say anything witty. I think it's all been done. So I'll just get on with it. We've just got 15 minutes each to talk tonight, so we are going to be talking from a prepared speech. We would have preferred just to talk, but then it can go on over time. So I'll start off by saying that Elizabeth and I chose the title Facing the Dragon, Meeting a Life Challenge Head On for our combined talk tonight for various reasons. Not the least that it ties together our two stories, which on the surface may seem very different, but in fact have several common themes. Two women, one in their 20s, another in her early 30s, obviously not recently, but at the time, come across life-changing obstacles that simply aren't going to go away. Neither of us expected to encounter these particular obstacles, whoever does, and we had no idea what the future would hold as a consequence, but nor were we the type to back down readily from a challenge. Both Elizabeth and I were living overseas at the time. I was in Hong Kong, married to my second husband, Tim, who's hiding at the back there, riding the crest of the wave, both professionally and personally, when I found out I could never conceive naturally. That discovery came at 35, after 2 years of doctors, tests, drugs, and treatments, expecting that every month I would find myself pregnant. It was after an eventual laparoscopy that I was given the very final verdict, the only way you'll ever have a baby is through IVF or adoption. It was about this time that Tim and I incorporated the phrase, face the dragon, into our relationship. This was the first major hurdle we had come up against as a unit, and it seemed appropriate living in Hong Kong, where even the name Kowloon, as Tim was telling me the other day, Kowloon actually means nine dragons, and that refers to the nine hills that form the dragon's backbone. So when you're actually on Hong Kong Island looking over to Kowloon, that is the dragon's backbone. Over the years, we went on to use that phrase every time we came up against something where the immediate temptation is either to back off, run screaming, or lie on the ground and kick your legs in the air, or all three. Facing the dragon helps gear us up for battle and raises our spirits while we go about it. Still in its pioneer years, I knew next to nothing about in vitro fertilisation, and my doctor wasn't much better informed. The good news was that I could do it in Sydney. The bad news was that there was a waiting list of 2 years, 2 years when you're 35 and everyone around you is having their first or second child is a painfully long time, especially with such an uncertain outcome. So I set about trying to get around the obstacle. I had a botched IVF attempt at a Hong Kong teaching hospital. I went to faith healers, I drank Chinese herbs, I did almost anything I could, but it wasn't to be. Then I rang every adoption agency I could find, only to be told I was too late, too old, or the wrong religion. I offered to change, but that didn't make any difference either. But speaking of change, I changed as a person. While I still held down a demanding job and kept up with my friends, my internal focus had shifted. I now lived in a world of fertility drugs, ovulation charts, and suspended motherhood, until finally I made it to the top of the list at the Royal North Shore. I entered that program with all the optimism of an Olympian, and as Tim says, we gave it our best shot. And it really is a wee thing. You have to have a supportive partner or you'll never get through it. But after another half dozen failed attempts, our resources were dwindling and so was my health. It was time to walk away. One of the reasons we left Hong Kong after 10 years was that I had a last IVF attempt up my sleeve. We had a frozen embryo in storage at the Royal North Shore, and everything now rode on this one microscopic speck of life to give us our family. I was in my late 30s, but still utterly determined that this would work according to plan. My plan, if not anybody else's. And I'd just like to read an excerpt about that particular time. I felt in good physical and emotional shape for the treatment ahead of me, and reasoned that without the need for air travel and my return to work, our embryo had a fighting chance of going full term. The last treatment cycle began just like all the others. We had daily visits to the hospital for blood and urine collection, and while I wasn't on Pergonol to stimulate egg production, I was given injections to balance my hormones and help create the ideal environment for our embryo's successful return to my body. I was in high spirits, confident, happy, and relaxed. Friends from Hong Kong rang a few days before I was due for embryo transfer. "We're in Sydney, love to see you, can we come round?" They walked in, a reminder of the stylish Hong Kong life we'd shared. She was beautifully dressed, carefully made up, wearing the kind of jewellery worn every day in Hong Kong, but in more casual Sydney, it seemed almost tacky. We were in shorts and probably had more than a few dog hairs on us. Clearly it was we who had changed. "How's Frozen Freddy?" asked my friend, a Marni sundress showing off her sleek, suntanned shoulders. "Who?" I wasn't being dumb, I just didn't make the connection. "Frozen Freddy, that's what we've nicknamed your embryo." She smiled at her husband, then back at me. "Let's have a toast to Freddy. David, open the champagne we brought." I didn't feel like champagne, and I didn't like my embryo's nickname. I can't say why exactly. Perhaps it belittled what was for me one of the most vital times of my life. And I wasn't thinking in terms of a boy or a girl. I just wanted it to go from 16 cells to 32 to... I was alone when the clinic called. "Your embryo didn't survive the thawing process." "What? What do they mean?" My mind struggled to comprehend what it had never considered. "We're sorry. It was over." Now came the even greater challenge, and this is what two-thirds of my book is about. Having spent 10 years fixated on one goal, 10 years feeling removed from mainstream, while you're trying your best not to be, 10 years where you've put your time, money, passion and energy into something that's gone belly up, you've got to put it behind you. Rebuild your life as quickly as possible and try to regain some of what you've lost along the way. But as with most things in life, it wasn't going to be that simple. Another excerpt, I'll just read it from here, it's from the book. "I hope you understand that we may not see as much of you now that we've got kids. It's not that we won't want to spend time with you, but we'll be busy doing family stuff." I looked at Robin oddly. We'd just been to see his wife and newborn daughter at the Royal Women's Hospital in Paddington, then gone on to dinner with him and two other couples. Was it really necessary to make that remark when we'd been friends for years? I felt peculiar, suddenly isolated. "I don't think it'll be a problem. We like being around young kids, especially when we're close to their parents." I glugged my champagne and looked around the table. Each couple had started a family. We'd been at their weddings, knew them well. Was my infertility going to alter these friendships? Surely not. As well as being a confidant in troubled times, I'd been jubilant when their pregnancies were announced. I braved the dreaded hospital visits that left me feeling gutted. No, Robin was mistaken. Things would be the same as they'd always been. That conversation took place 18 months after we'd closed the door on in vitro fertilisation. It wasn't the first time I'd realised we were going to be different from most of our peer group, but it was the first time I realised our not having children was going to make a difference to them. Getting on with life included moving to a new home which we loved. For 5 months, things went swimmingly. I was getting regular freelance work, which was occupying my time as well as feeding my psyche. We were making new friends and generally getting back into the rhythm of things. Then one night, Tim walked in the door and said, "I've lost my job." It was the beginning of the recession of the early 90s and the end of our short dream run. After a year of unsuccessful job hunting, we rented out our new house, looked for temporary homes for our RSPCA-sourced, much-loved two dogs and cat, and moved back to Hong Kong. A friend of mine had commented years earlier that I was like one of those blow-up toys with sand at the base that you could hit repeatedly and it would always bounce back to the upright position. Not this time. I missed home, family and friends enormously. We moved into a small, sterile, serviced apartment where you couldn't even open the windows. I stopped sleeping. My body closed down, triggering a vain hope of pregnancy. For a while, it was a serious struggle to stay above water. But once again, good work opportunities and an optimistic outlook helped us make the best of the two additional years we were away, though I grieved deeply for all that I had lost and for all that, barring a miracle, I would never have. When we came home for the second time, I turned my attention to work. I wanted a fresh start, something to occupy me on every level. I moved away from the advertising industry, which had employed me as a copywriter since I was 16, and did a 2-year counselling course, graduating with a diploma and a truckload of invaluable life skills. I had told my colleagues the day I joined the counselling college that I wanted to write a book to help other women faced with infertility, and because of that desire, I needed to heal myself first. You can't write a book for other people or become a counsellor when you're not fully healed, and that's what I needed to do, and that was what the 2 years did. After qualifying, I worked as a counsellor for the next few years, seeing clients with a wide range of life problems. The expression, "everyone's fighting a battle of some kind," is never more evident than when you're working with people in a safe, non-judgmental environment. They can tell you their stories without the need to censor, without fear of recrimination. I was constantly reminded of the sameness of the human experience rather than what separates us. In 2002, I lost my mother and my favourite dog in the same week and felt like a hole had been blown right through my centre. Against all wisdom, it was just 2 weeks later that we drove home from Picton with a very large golden retriever puppy occupying my lap. Having a young, arthritis-free dog to walk again reconnected me with our community and some of the wonderful people in it. This last excerpt tells how the apparent simplicity of belonging can in itself be life-changing. It is one of the coldest winter days for a long time. I dig out my padded jacket, not worn last year, and button it up before opening the front door. The chill goes straight through me, and as I put the lead on Dougal, my breath hangs in the air. We walk across the oval, still sodden from the fierce June storm, and up a side street. A car drives past, and I lift my hand in recognition. I couldn't see the occupant, but I know the car belongs to a neighbour. My hands are frozen, turning blue. I shove one deep in my pocket while the other clings to the lead. I'm sniffing from the cold and my eyes water. I walk as fast as I can to get the blood circulating. It's 8:10. The main road is heavy with morning traffic. My head jerks up at a car's horn. My friend waves on the way back from her school run. I turn a corner, another car honks, a second friend and his kids all waving like mad. I imagine the kids yelling, "There's Dougal!" Now a car toots going in the other direction. I wave at a friend's husband on his way to the office. At the same time, another neighbour drives past with her two children. Warm now, we make our way back to the oval opposite our house, where a good friend joins me for the last bit of the walk. Her eldest son is about to go overseas. She's sad, I commiserate. On the front veranda, I wipe the mud from Dougal's feet. Two kookaburras and a butcher bird watch me, turning their heads as a neighbour walking to the station calls out a greeting. For the first time in my life, I've put down roots. It was with this sense of belonging, of having come full circle, and with enough emotional distance from the two previous decades that I began to write When the Bough Breaks. I wrote it to share, not just with childless women like me, but with every woman who's ever contemplated motherhood and what it means to her. Thank you.
Thanks, thanks, Joanne. So now, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Exactly. Well, thank you very much. Facing the dragon, these words to me conjure up images of swords and courage and fearlessness. But I don't really feel I can claim to have such courage, given that my dragon was forced to beat me around the head a number of times before I acknowledged it was actually there. It seems that dragons and denial can make strange and protracted alliances. Marzipan and Magnolias is in part about my reluctant and circuitous path towards acceptance of a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. But there's another theme running through the book which to me is of equal importance, and that is the powerful influence of the mother-daughter relationship. I think that all women have a mother-daughter story to tell. I think it's a relationship that is integral in shaping who we are and perhaps predictive of how we respond to life's unpredictable events. So I began writing the book as a way of sorting through a difficult period in my life when a number of things had come together. My father had died, my health had been deteriorating, and there was the emergence of worrying neurological symptoms relating to the MS. And the backdrop to these events was the complex relationship with my mother, which involved us keeping secrets on both sides. I sometimes use the analogy that it felt as though my brain had become like one of those kitchen drawers that I think many of us have, with too many phone recharging cables in it, that it all become tied up in knots, and I needed to find a way to unravel the cables to make sense of it all. But I'll just backtrack a little to sort of put all of that into some kind of context. I grew up in a somewhat eccentric family, the only girl with three brothers. And my mother in that family was definitely the chief eccentric, a larger-than-life character who felt and feels passionately about many issues, but by far her most passionately held beliefs are about religion. I think it would be fair to say that she is evangelically atheist, and this has provided a strange structure, or perhaps anti-structure, to the way our family deals with death. We just don't do death in our family. So the curious thing is how this thing that isn't there can cast such a long shadow. And curious too that it managed to give some kind of structure to the shape of the book, opening with my mother's refusal to go to her father's funeral when I was about seven, and then late in the book with my father's death and, well, the complete absence of a funeral altogether. My father was also a little bit on the eccentric side, but in a less voluble, more clenched-teeth, neurotic kind of fashion. He was the world's most unlikely real estate agent and spent his working life tormented by clients who were clearly determined never, ever to buy a house. My teenage years saw the real estate slump of the 1970s, And while parenting didn't come naturally to Dad, this meant he carried the financial burden of having four children heavily. He came home from work most days a defeated man, but nothing irritated him more than clients ringing him at home, no matter how desperate he was for a sale. So as my mother held out the phone for him, saying Mr. or Mrs. Bloggs was on the phone, he would be doing loud impersonations of them, even better if they were foreign, because he could do their accent as well. And while this enraged my mother, who thought he should really be focusing on closing a deal, for me, I found his ability to do these foreign accents absolutely captivating, and foreign accents became a complete preoccupation for me, which ended up shaping the direction of my life. So my brothers and I had a lot of independence growing up, as I think all of us who grew up in the 60s and 70s did, and the one time of year that we were all shoved together was for the annual trip north along the Pacific Highway, which was back then, probably still is, clogged with caravans and Sunday drivers. Add to the torture of the 15 hours on sweaty vinyl car seats, a brother with motion sickness, a flatulent kelpie, a duck with a bad attitude, and my mother at the wheel. It didn't make for great bonding. Still, my mother was a very important and influential figure in my life, and my most favoured child status, being the only girl, had ensured some degree of insulation from her sometimes strange responses to emotionally confronting situations. So I really wasn't prepared for it when things became prickly, when I, as a young adult, chose to take myself off to Europe to immerse myself in foreign accents, and it became progressively more prickly when she realised I'd fallen for a German named Martin, and things continued to deteriorate when she realised I was moving from London, where I was working, to West Berlin to be with Martin. And that began the internal tug of war for me, a struggle to achieve independence, but also to break through the barriers that had developed between Mum and me. It was in Berlin that I experienced my first episode of multiple sclerosis, which was a very bizarre episode of where I lost my ability to taste and to swallow on the right side of my tongue and my throat. I had worked as an occupational therapist in London and in Sydney on neurology wards, so I knew it wasn't good. It was 1985 and MRI scans were only just coming into use, and it's those scans which are able to pick up the telltale white plaques on the brain that point to a diagnosis of MS. Instead, the CT technology which was available doesn't show up those things, and so a diagnosis back then was only made by virtue of something being multiple, so you had to have numerous episodes to be diagnosed. So although it was mentioned to me that that was a possibility, once the symptoms resolved after about a month, I was able to just put my head in the sand and carry on as if nothing had happened. It would be many years before I received a formal diagnosis, by which time Martin and I had married, had two children, and were living in New York. New York was a really defining period for me. I found the city itself to be absolutely exhilarating, and I had the freedom of children being in school. I wasn't working while we were there. And on a whim, I enrolled in a writing course in Manhattan, which turned out to be, for me, the most exciting thing I'd ever done. So there I was, busy enjoying my life, practicing my writing, when MS reared its most unwelcome head again. And it was after this point that things really began to ramp up with successive episodes, but I just didn't want to know about it. So even as my health continued to deteriorate after our return to Australia, I refused to acknowledge it, disregarding the significance of these episodes. I'd revealed my diagnosis to only a few people, and Mum wasn't one of them. So it was from this point that the two themes in the book, the mother-daughter story and the MS, really become entwined. My attempts to ignore MS and conceal it from my mother were ultimately futile when I was clobbered with an episode which resulted in my loss of vision and balance and strength, and I ended up in hospital. Up after that, I was really left very weak. The neurological symptoms resolved, but it took a very, very long time for me to begin to get my strength back. And there wasn't a lot I could do physically, but I could sit at the computer and write. And interestingly, that writing gave me a real sense of purpose. And although I was writing about difficult issues, it provided a sense of escape and even somehow a sense of control. In a way, I wrote it almost backwards because I was trying to sort of, as I mentioned, unravel the telephone cables. I wrote a bit, tried to make sense of that. Then I felt I needed to go back to find out how I had arrived at that point and so on and so forth, until I drilled back to that scene I mentioned before of being 7 years old and observing my mother refusing to go to her father's funeral. And that was a real kind of light bulb moment for me, because I realised it explained or predicted much about her strange responses to emotionally confronting issues. And in turn, it allowed me to recognise those parts of her personality which are reflected in my own, particularly in relation to my diagnosis of MS. Another intriguing discovery I made through the writing of this book was that memoir is about recording life experiences, yet somehow the writing process can become entwined with events yet to be lived and can point to conversations that need to be taken and action that needs to be taken. So writing the book and the subsequent conversations I had with my mother allowed me to understand her better, and almost imperceptibly during the writing process, I found a way to come to terms with living with MS. I realised that I had always been afraid of being diagnosed, defined by my diagnosis, and it gradually became clear to me that the only person defining me by my diagnosis was me. So, belatedly, I did come face to face with the dragon I'd been avoiding for so many years and found a way to incorporate it into my life. So I'd just like to finish with a reading, and I'll just set the scene. This takes place on an island in the North Sea in the dead of winter. My husband's parents had retired to this island many years before, and they had died some months earlier, and my husband wanted the two children and me to go with him to be with his sister, spend Christmas there, and to sort through various things that still needed to be done. So that's where we were, and it was very, very cold. After dinner, the phone rang. Martin answered it. I could tell straight away from his voice that something was wrong. He looked at me, but it seemed to take forever for him to get the words out. It's your mother. Your dad has passed away. Even in that moment, I was irritated by his use of the euphemism. Why not just say died? But by the time I took the phone, my throat was so tight I couldn't speak. Not that it was necessary, as Mum launched in, talking at a million miles an hour. It was pneumonia, she said, the old man's friend, they used to call it. He didn't suffer. I thought he wasn't right before you left, but I didn't say anything. After all, what was the point? He's really been gone for a year when you think about it, and Martin needed you there. But he wasn't right. He died 3 days after you left. What? When did he die? 3 days after you left. Remember I said I wouldn't let you know if something happened? It's been difficult not to tell you. We've had to keep the whole thing quiet in case one of your friends rang you in Germany. My mind was as frozen as the wind outside as I tried to calculate precisely how long ago he'd died. So while I'd been answering polite questions from Martin's relatives about my father's health, he was actually already dead. It was as though I'd been existing in some parallel universe. What about the funeral? Oh, there's no funeral. He's already been cremated, but I didn't go. None of us did. Dreadful place, the crematorium. Evil. I didn't want to tell you, but Tim said it's getting so long that if I didn't tell you, he would. I was struggling to process the information. Why didn't you let me know sooner? Remember, we talked about this before you left. She was right, but we hadn't exactly talked about it. She had simply announced, in her most matter-of-fact tone, that if something happened to Dad, she wouldn't tell me until I got back. I was used to such comments from Mum. She always said something to that effect before I travelled, even years before when both my parents were fit and well. Other people's mothers might say, make sure you phone straight away if you need anything. My mother says, just enjoy yourself and I won't bother you if anyone dies while you're away. Do you want me to come home? No, heavens no. What for? I'm fine. She sounded over amp like someone on speed. When I hung up, Martin asked me what I wanted to do. I want to be near the water, I said. The kids were already asleep and Dirt had stayed with them while we drove to the ferry wharf. The howl of the wind was so loud we didn't bother trying to talk. I looked out over the black ocean and wondered which direction Australia was from where I was standing. It was literally at the other end of the earth. That night I felt elated that Dad was free of that place. The indignity had ended. Then the numbness set in. We continued our daily routine of going over to the house and sorting things into boxes, but I had the sensation of being contained in a pressure cooker. I kept telling myself that it was good news, a release for Dad for all of us after a year of torment. Why did it matter that I hadn't known? Why did it matter that there was no funeral? At night I'd lie awake in bed and wonder that I felt nothing. Nothing except the incessant tingling in my legs. I wondered if that's what a DBT felt like, but I didn't recall tingling being a sign, and surely I wouldn't have one in both legs. But every night there it was, tingling from toes to thighs. The days dragged on. Finally I told Martin I had to go home. It didn't matter that there was no point, I just had to go home. Thank you.
So many thanks to our speakers, both of whom kept to the scheduled time. We always like to complete the triangle at Sydney Institute, and I made the point that both our authors happen to know or happen to find out that they're both members of the same yogurt club, and lo and behold, so is our bookseller Janet Grundy, who happens to be a member of the same yogurt club. So we're keeping all this in the yogurt family. So Janet Grundy's got some copies of Joanne W. Jones's When the Bow Breaks and Elizabeth Lancaster's Marzipan and Magnolias. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7. There's no need to stand up because we've got a camera down the back and we don't want to get in the way of that. So I'll start off. I think when we start off, we may get you standing one side and the other side of this. Mm-hmm. But I'll start off asking both of you, coming off the back of Elizabeth's book, you made the point that your Schumann was a Protestant family of some kind, didn't do death very well. I came up in a Catholic family. We did death terrifically well, actually. From a young age, I was told, very young age, I was always told, you'll never know the day nor the hour. And as I got older, you'll never know the day nor the hour nor the minute. But what you've spoken about, death, and you've spoken about, Joanne, you've spoken about your own attitudes to various problems. But neither of you, as I recall, have mentioned the concept of grief. Does that come up in your own in your own attitudes? Do you look at the concept of grief, or is that something you just happen to bypass? So let's start with Elizabeth, then we'll go to Joanne, and then we'll go to the rest. So if one of you stand on this side, and I'll stand over here. You're talking to the microphone.
Oh, right. Yeah. Sorry. Well, I think that was a very interesting part of it, that I think my mother's goal with not doing death was that there would then be no grief. But what I learned was that because there wasn't that opportunity, there was no way to work through it. And so I really did go into a period of numbness for quite a long time, that I was part of the telephone cable thing that I really needed to get to the bottom of. So I think that grief is a very big part of the story, and learning to deal with it, learning to find a way through it in an unconventional way.
So, Joanne.
Well, I didn't want to depress the hell out of everybody, but yes, you know, I went through an enormous amount of grief, and the thing with grief is, you think you're over it and it comes back again. And anybody who's lost anybody who's been through tragedy knows that grief is one of those things that comes in waves. Big ones to begin with, and then little ones, and then just when you think, right, it's not happening, whack, over you go. So yes, there was a lot of grief. And it's in the book. I didn't live my life grieving. I got on and lived my life, but my grief was there.
Okay, so pushing it. Now, when you answer, could you, one of you to stand, both you stand in front of the microphone individually. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just on this subject you just talked about grief, but you said in your talk, you mentioned that you knew when you healed. Well, how do you know that?
The question is, in the book there's a mention that you knew when you healed. How do you know when you healed?
Yeah. I knew when I'd healed sufficiently to be able to go out and deal with other people's emotions, because when I came through the 2 years of the counselling college, that was almost one of the premises that I graduated under. We had a very, very excellent head of the college, and there were a couple of girls there who weren't attending to what you would call their issues, and they didn't graduate. I have another graduate in the room tonight, as a matter of fact, who'll know exactly what I mean when I say we had to have done our stuff. And it's only by going through a 2-year counselling course that I could explain how I knew. But I did. I came away from there as healed as I was going to be.
That's the only thing that's sort of contradictory to the fact that grief comes and hits you when you don't expect it. So
yeah.
You probably never
heal. Yeah. Like having a wooden leg, you just get used to it. It doesn't bother you any longer, put it that way. But it's a good question.
I want to ask Elizabeth, and could you tell us how your mother took your illness? That she didn't do death well. I mean, she sounds like she was a very capable, strong-minded,
yes,
get on and fix everything up kind of person. What did she do when she found out you were sick? Because you tried not to tell her.
Yes.
So you were falling into her trap.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, she behaved in probably the way I would have expected, in that she wanted to... We didn't ever get to talk about it, about sort of emotional implications of it or the difficulties of it. She just wanted to do stuff. So I would wake up from a rest to the aroma of tuna mornay in my house, which I have loathed ever since childhood. And Mum would be there making tuna mornay so that I didn't have to cook dinner. Well, I'd rather just eat grass than have to eat tuna mornay. But I had to struggle very hard to be able to maintain my independence, because I felt that if I gave way to allowing her to do this, I would never be able to do anything. And so it was this ongoing battle to prove that I could do it and that I didn't need help. And I probably did need some help, but it was very hard to find that that balancing act. So we never talk about it. It's something that she might mention that she's seen an article that I should read in the newspaper or something, but we don't really go much further than that.
Yes, we have heard what facing the dragon means, but could you elaborate a bit on the title of your book, Marzipan and Magnolias?
Okay, so Marzipan, in Germany, whenever at Christmas time we always ate chocolate-covered marzipan, and it was exactly when I was eating a piece of chocolate-covered marzipan that I lost this sense of taste. And then, strangely enough, many years later, I had a repeat of that very same particular episode of losing the sense of taste, and it was Christmas time and there was the marzipan there, and I chose not to try it because I knew what was coming. But so the marzipan sort of represents the MS in the story, and Magnolias, my mother, is a passionate gardener, and I'm also quite a keen gardener. I don't have her green thumb, but the garden is a place where we can really connect. We don't need to talk about emotions or relationships or anything like that. We just talk about plants. And she has, there's a particular part in the book, it's a bit of a turning point, where she gives me a magnolia, which is called Magnolia Elizabeth. And So the magnolias represents her in the story.
Thank you.
I'm interested in knowing your opinion about what sort of role close family members play while you go through the process of writing, especially when you're writing such a heavy, difficult things. I mean, are there outsiders, or they come into the book? Do they pay attention to what you're doing, Colin?
Well, my family members didn't, apart from my husband, of course, didn't know that I was writing the book. And because I wasn't ever intending for it to be a book, actually. I was really just writing for myself. And so it just gradually evolved and became a book, at which point, of course, I had to tell them, and my brothers read it, and they were very pleased with it. They felt very happy to be included in that. And then, of course, I had to talk to my mother about it, of course, because I didn't want to publish something that would be upsetting to her. So I told her that I had written this book, that it had been nominated for this prize, and but I didn't want to go ahead if it was going to upset her. And she is, if nothing else, a pragmatist, and when she found out that there was prize money associated with it, and she is, a child of the Depression era, there was absolutely no question that, don't be ridiculous, of course you should publish it, but I won't read it. And that's pretty much, so, the book is there, she hasn't read it, and it's much the same as the way we deal with everything else, so true to character. Yes.
Well, I'm an absolute coward. I waited for 2 years after my father had died before I decided to do anything with this book. He would have had a fit of some of the things that were in there. I've been described as being wonderfully frank and honest by a couple of the journalists that have reviewed my book. And in being frank, I've also exposed some of the imperfections in our family, which my father in particular would have just collapsed on the spot. So I waited, and he, bless him, isn't around, so there's nobody to offend. I only have a brother who won't read it, so that's no problem. My cousins, my nephews, all my other family members are thrilled that it's written and thrilled that it's out there and it's achieving the goal it's set out to. And my husband is a very brave man who doesn't mind being in the book because he comes out looking so good. Everyone says, "You have such a wonderful husband." And I say, "Well, I only put in the good bits." But,
John, from your experiences, have you insights that women are far more sophisticated to deal with the complexities of life than males?
Let's start with
you. Can ask.
Elizabeth, then we go to Joanne. Talk at that little bit.
Yes. I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Well, the question is, would it be able to cope with this kind of problem as men?
Communicate or really be there at the level of the yoga club?
Well, I don't really know that I handled it especially well. I think that I was far too reluctant to share a lot of information about my illness and so on that would have benefited me, I think. So I don't know that, and how would my husband have handled it? He may have been more open. So I don't know that. I think certainly the writing side of it helped me enormously. I don't know if that's more of a female thing to sit down and just work through those difficult things on paper. I don't know. Do you have a...
Yes, on the male-female thing, I think some men probably express themselves terribly well in print emotionally. And I'm not talking about all these new age sort of characters. There are just some men who are very capable of doing it. As a woman, I've always found it easier to talk from the heart than to talk a lot of BS. So, to put it simply, the kind of person I am is the person who could write a book like that without any problems. And I'm sure there's a lot of men out there as well. not the one I'm married to. He would have a fit at the thought of having to express himself like that. But he is the closest person to me in my life, and he supported me the whole way through the writing, as well as through all the processes we've been through, through the writing, because it was telling his story too, and he was happy for me to do that, so that says something.
You mentioned that you graduated in counselling.
Yes.
But as you know, there's that old refrain, get over it. I mean, is counselling that important? Is there something to be said for people, for the argument that counselling can often just prolong the concern about the problem and you're better trying to forget it? I mean, obviously you favour counselling, but how do you see that other argument?
My experience of counselling is like many other things you do in life. They are footsteps to get you out of there. And whatever it is that works for you, if coming to see a particular counsellor works very well and helps you start to deal with your problem, so be it. If running 10 miles every morning naked on the beach does it, well, do that. But you have to find, I believe every human being has to find their own way out of problems, and counselling isn't for everybody. But the people that came to see me all were looking for someone that they could just tell their story to and be supported where they were. A counsellor isn't there to fix their problems, just to support them where they are.
Now, Elizabeth, obviously your mother wouldn't be into counselling.
No.
But what's your own attitude?
Look, I think that counselling is like the untangling the cables I keep on going back to. So I think that if you speak to someone who can help you get a little bit of distance and help you start to unravel the cables, then that's absolutely wonderful. I think for me, writing was the best thing I could have done, because it just allowed me to put it down on paper and then step back from it, because once it was on the page, it was a story then, and what I was working on then was crafting the story, and I managed to just get some distance through doing that.
Your mother is obviously a classic psychiatrist. Is there a book in just your mother, even if it was partly fictional one to some extent, where you don't? Because really and truly, that is a character that's obviously got an enormous amount of baggage, but never should unravel her cases, because when she did,
oh, no,
she'd be completely she'd be dysfunctional.
Oh, but I see.
Can you give us a bit more about why she got there and a bit more about...
Look, she, in terms of a character, she is a gift, because the dialogue that you get from Mum is just, you just have to write it down. You don't need to do anything else to it. And you think, of course she would say that. How could I have even wondered what the outcome would be? Why she is like that? She grew up in the country. She was sent off to boarding school when she was in, just for secondary school.
She grew up in country New South Wales.
Yes.
Okay.
And she describes her mother as a very difficult woman, which I find interesting. And her mother was older when she had my mother, and then my mother had one brother who was about 7 years younger. So by the time Mum went off to boarding school, so in a way she was sort of an only child. And it was wartime. They didn't have much money. My grandfather was a dairy farmer, and they could only afford for her to go home, I think, once a year. And even then, it wasn't a booked seat. She stood all the way on the mail train from Sydney to Casino, 15 hours. Well, she then paid us back with these horrendous trips up to it in the car. But I think she was just very self-sufficient. She'd just learned to, and you just didn't go there. This is just how life was. And
put on the armour.
Yes.
So where did she board?
Abbotsley.
Oh, my goodness.
On the north shore of Sydney, near Barunga.
Yeah.
Right, there's a question here. Now, speak up a bit.
With what you're doing about doing debt in your family, are you...
This is to Elizabeth.
Yes.
Well, fortunately, there haven't been that many opportunities to deal with it yet, but... I mean, I always wished that I was Catholic. I just love the whole... palaver that goes along with everyone goes off to everyone's funeral, whereas we're far more restrained about, you know, did I really know the person? And but I did go through a stage of becoming a bit of a funeral junkie, but any time, any excuse, I would be there because, you know, I just really needed to go through that. And that was for myself, not for, fortunately I wasn't dragging my children off to people's funerals, but I think that I would certainly I certainly recognise the importance of that moment, that it's going to allow you to at least absorb the fact that, you know, someone has died. And even if you don't believe in the religious aspect of it, or you disapprove of, you know, the cost or whatever, there needs to be some kind of decommissioning service at least that you can sort of acknowledge that moment. And I mean, my father was not young. He'd had dementia for a year. He was in a nursing home. This was not a tragic loss, which has made it all the more curious that I just struggled with it so much, the fact that there wasn't that moment to sort of stop and deal with it. So yes, I think I would encourage funerals at every, you know, opportunity.
I suppose I'm also meaning in a more general sense, not just the doing death, but just the displaying of emotion in your family life. Is that something you're finding easy, or coming from the family?
Yes, I think so. I mean, my daughter is very open. She's very affectionate, and it's really a case of too much information most of the time. And I think we're a very close family, and so I think that something has shifted in that regard. Yeah.
So, Helen?
Question for Joanne, which is about the mother-daughter relationship with your own mother.
Yes.
So your infertility is something you were able to share with your mother, discuss with your mother, and was she able to be understanding the circumstances and help you, or was it a barrier between you?
Unfortunately, my mother would have liked to have helped me more than she actually did. Mum was one of those people who could never front up to a challenge. She was, if you like, very opposite to me. So if things got too hard, she'd always say, well, Daddy will take care of that. So even when I was trying to have the baby, and I was working in Hong Kong and flying back to Sydney to do the treatments, and I was staying at home, my mother was the one who was suffering all the time. So when it didn't work and I used to fly back to Hong Kong, it was my mother who had to be taken off on a little holiday to recover. So she made the whole thing about her, which was kind of what my mum did. But, you know, I excuse her and I forgive her because she couldn't be any other way. But I would have... I discovered one of the things I've been asked was the book writing cathartic. No, it wasn't cathartic. I didn't write it to be cathartic. I wrote it because I just had to write it. And I wrote it because I wanted to share it, as I've said. But the one thing I did discover that was terribly revealing is perhaps one of my greatest motivators in wanting to get pregnant was so that I'd get my mother's love. I thought then I would get it. So,
just as a final question to you, Joanne, and then to Elizabeth. Now I've been distracted of my I know what it was. You were always a writer.
Mm.
In advertising, you spent your lifetime
and PR,
writing
and, yes.
In various forms, professionally and otherwise.
Yes.
And obviously you... you didn't have to write this, but you wanted to.
Mm.
But Joanne, your background... Elizabeth, your background wasn't really in writing, was it?
No.
You felt a need to write it. So,
I have
are you likely to write this kind of work again?
I started another one.
So what's your next book on?
Well, it's going to start off earlier in life when I'm at boarding school in England. I am an Aussie, but because my father married an English woman, I sound like I'm English. Anyway, it's going to start up there, and it's going to explore women's, how you get your self-image, how you discover your sexuality, just basically the journey that women get to form themselves as an adult. And it's going to be lighter than this last book. I hope it'll be quite quite amusing to read, but the theme will be women and our self-image, our self-esteem and our sexuality, and what forms it on the way.
And Elizabeth?
Well, I had been writing, I had sort of moved sideways from being an occupational therapist into writing before I wrote this and before I became unwell. And even throughout the writing of this, which took me quite a long time, I have written a lot of other short stories which are not part of this. And I think it's something that I will always do, whether or not I have a book contract, I will just be writing because it's what I love to do. So from that moment of taking the very first writing course in New York, I have written. So I think I will continue
to do so. What are you planning to do next? Anything in particular? Or?
Well, I prefer the short story format. And I do have a lot of short stories at home. And I'm just trying to work out how and if they hang together. I'm sort of seeing what direction it takes me.
Okay. Many thanks. Take a seat, folks.
Thank you.
So Jenna Grundy's got some copies of When the Bar Breaks by Joanne W. Jones and Elizabeth Lancaster's book Marzipan and Magnolias. Anne put this on tonight, and I had preferred it was Janet's suggestion, so it was all part of the yoga conspiracy. So, the yoga mafia, yeah. I'd looked at the topics and the titles, and I thought it all seemed like a pretty grim night, actually. So I had a bit of brandy before we started just to make sure I could get through it. But it was an insightful night, but it was also a highly amusing night. I've had a while of a time, and I'm sure I will remember this night for a long time, and I think other people in the room will too, because it was two authors approaching sensitive topics in a thoughtful way, but also in a light-hearted and, to some extent, irreverent way, which made it, I guess, all the more memorable. I can understand why both books got shortlisted for the Finch Memoir Prize, and I've no doubt we'll have both Elizabeth and Joanne back in the future, but for tonight, well done to both of you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.